Tonight, of course, is a very special Tuesday evening's presentation. Michael Opping has given many of these lectures over his time at the Modern, but as you likely know, Michael recently retired from the Modern and has entered the next chapter of his considerable career. So tonight he has agreed to come back and, to my mind, cap his time here by sharing 40 years of amazing stories, exhibitions, and experiences with those of us who have benefited so greatly from his contributions to this institution and beyond. In some ways, Michael's history is our history. With that in mind, and for the sake of time, I have edited his history accomplishments to those that that are familiar to many of us, but nevertheless merit mentioning. Michael is, at his core, a Californian, having grown up in Southern California with a BA and an MA in art history from California State University, Long Beach. His career took off quickly as a writer and curator, with him leaving California and eventually moving to Buffalo, where he was chief curator at the Albright Knox Art Gallery from 1984 to 93, before coming to Fort Worth to serve in the same capacity for the Modern from 1993 to 2017. The list of exhibitions he conceived and organized throughout his career is long and most impressive. Many here tonight have matured as art students and art enthusiasts on much of that list. Again, for the sake of time, I will refrain from listing all of my favorites. I do, however, need to remind some and inform others here tonight that Michael Opping and Jenny Holzer, early in Holzer's career, took the Best Pavilion Prize at the 1990 Venice Biennale, where Michael curated Jenny's work for the U.S. Pavilion. In 2000, Michael was one of six curators for that year's Whitney Biennial, where, among other things, he was chosen to direct the installation of the exhibition. For those of us familiar with Michael's work, that contribution was immediately apparent upon seeing the show. His aesthetic is undeniable. And finally, because it is close to home and about as Texas as you can get, Michael is and has been since 2008 on the Art Advisory Council for Dallas Cowboys Stadium and Collection, a collection that has introduced a lot of unsuspecting football fans to some very good art. All of this is to say, Michael Graham Opping has made us all very proud, and it is our honor to have him here tonight. So please join me in showing our appreciation with a warm and sincere welcome.
Thank you so much, Terry. Thank all of you. For many of my colleagues and a lot of my friends, I will always be associated with Fort Worth Art Museum, and that's fine with me. 25 years, it's been a privilege to be here, frankly. But I'm an old guy, which means I actually had a career before I came to Fort Worth. And since this book that we're releasing tonight is semi-autobiographical, I thought I'd talk about how I got to Fort Worth and some of the strange connections that happened on the way. I grew up in Southern California, went to Cal State Long Beach. It was great to be in L.A. at a time when L.A. was not famous. I literally picked up the phone book, found Robert Irwin's name, got his phone number and called him and said, "I'd like to come over. I'm doing an article on your work," which is a lie, "and I'd like to see your new work." I drove on the 405 down to Venice Beach, walked in the studio to find an empty studio. And I said, "Well, where's the new work?" And he said, "Well, I've been working on the studio, and that kind of is the new work." I said, "Well, what have you done?" And he said, "Well, I've plastered the walls because the paintings feel softer when they're presented on plaster walls. And then if you look up, I made those two skylights. And the light in this room is very special." So for those of you who often talk about or wonder about why my exhibitions are so sparely designed, I started in an empty room. Now, the paintings that Bob was working on around the time that this photo was taken were called the line paintings, and they were extremely subtle. It was a painting about this size with a one-color ground and a line that went from edge to edge that was almost the same color as the ground, but just elevated a little bit by thickness. You could barely see it. Very subtle. I decided to do a show of these line paintings, and there were very few of them. One of the owners of the line paintings was a man named Sid Bass from Fort Worth, Texas. I asked him if he would lend the picture. He said, no, it's too valuable. It's, you know, I'm afraid it'll get hurt. I said, no, you got to do it. I called Bob. Bob called Sid Bass. Said, you know, you really should lend this, Sid. So Sid lent the painting. Big success. Got my first review in Art Forum with that line painting show. Put the painting back in the crate. On the way home at the airport, someone drove a forklift through the crate. Punctured the painting. Sid Bass's painting, who didn't want to lend anyway. Ooh, he was pissed. I'd never heard a Texan be pissed. So I actually had Bob call him. I couldn't do it. And I felt really horrible, but I consoled myself with the thought that, hell, I'll never be in Fort Worth, Texas. I'll never meet Bob Bass, whoever the hell that is. Another artist studio that I visited at a very young time in my career was Ed Ruscha. And both Irwin and Ruscha changed my concept of what an artist was supposed to be like. I always thought an artist was supposed to be hot and expressive. And these guys were totally cool and understated. Bob was phenomenologically cool. You know, how do we see? That's what he talked about. Ed was conceptually cool and stylistically cool. This is a photograph of Ed, his good friend Joe Good, and an artist named Jerry McMillan on Ed's 1950 Ford sedan. This is the 1950 Ford sedan that Ed Ruscha drove from his hometown of Oklahoma City to Hollywood, California, a famous trip down Route 66 that he documented by taking photographs of gas stations. His book, 26 Gasoline Stations, changed conceptual art. People acknowledge this as a major turning point in how art was looked at from a conceptual standpoint. And he made some fantastic paintings of standard stations. This is one of the great ones. It is owned by, guess who? Ed Bass. But Ed was important to those of us in LA because he was a landscape painter, but he was really making, he was a landscape painter, a landscape photographer, but he was also making a portrait of Los Angeles at a time when Los Angeles in the art world was not considered that important. So when he makes a painting called a boulevard called Sunset, like everyone just recognizes the feeling that those words make, or Ice Princes on the Hollywood Freeway. So, another artist, finally, the trifecta of artists that many artists I met in L.A., but, you know, the really big ones stick in your mind. Bruce Nauman was one of those artists. Bruce's first studio was in Northern California. It was in an old grocery store. And when he rented the studio, he inherited a beer sign. And the beer sign was in the window. You can't see it here. But it inspired Bruce to make one of his most famous works. The true artist helps the world by revealing mystic truths. So Bruce was an artist, to my mind, that was both cool and hot. In other words, he knew how to be cool conceptually, but his work had a hot humanistic quality to it. I remember going to Santa Ana College. It was a community college in Santa Ana, California, where Bruce was making a piece called Yellow Triangular Room. And it was a triangular room flooded with hot yellow light. And I asked him if I could help him make it. And he said, nope, got to do this myself. He literally took out the 2x4s out of his truck, used a saw, hammer, and nails, and built a yellow triangular room. And then put these hot, intense, fluorescent yellow lights in it. Then I asked him, what are you going to put in the room? And Bruce just laughed and left. To be continued with Bruce. So in 1977, I cut my hair and I moved to Berkeley, California to become a curator at the University Art Museum in Berkeley. They had started a program called Matrix, and it's hard for many of you to believe this, but there was a time when contemporary art was not shown in museums. I know you don't believe that, but it is true. It was not shown in museums. If it was shown, it was just barely shown in a little corner room. Well, the director I worked for, James Elliott, and the artist Saul LeWitt, who became a good friend of mine, had designed this idea of a program called Matrix, meaning something that comes out of something, that would allow art to be shown in a contemporary art museum on a regular basis. And they hired me to do it. And I really took it to heart, maybe a little too much. The first year, I did 13 shows. That's a lot of shows. And one of my first shows was of a young woman named Susan Rothenberg. Susan was in New York at a time when abstraction was holding court, making paintings of horses. It perplexed everyone. And it perplexed me. I wasn't sure what these horses were about or where they came from. All I knew is when I visited her studio, it was this young, energetic woman making these horses. As it turned out, what I was seeing in Susan Rothenberg's work was a new generation in which artists were starting to cross boundaries. Information in other media was leaking in to different other mediums. And this was unusual, particularly in painting. You could see performance artists doing films, filmmakers doing performances, this kind of thing. In the case of Susan, it was performance leaking into painting. On the left, you see a performance by Joan Jonas at Jones Beach. Inside the wheel is the young Susan Rothenberg. On the right is a painting by Susan Rothenberg. The energy that I was seeing in Susan Rothenberg's paintings was coming out of her interest in performance art. Later, she showed me these photographs. And these are rare private studio photographs in which Susan is taking the pose, essentially, of a leaping horse or so when I look at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth's painting, Cabin Fever, I see Susan inside the horse. I mean, that's the energy that painting is about. One of my early shows was also of a guy named Richard Serra. And I really wanted to do a show of Richard Serra's sculpture. I mean, we were on a shoestring budget here, and we're talking about a $1 million project, and the director practically laughed me out of the room. And we decided that I would do a show of Richard Serra's wall drawings, which turned out to be pretty smart because Richard Serra was really expanding the dimension of what drawing could be. Using thick grease stick, he would make these monumental drawings on canvas, which he then stapled to walls. And these huge black voids would change your perception of how you saw the room, of how you felt about the wall in that room. So We were so poor at the University Art Museum in Berkeley that when Richard came out to do this show, he and his wife Clara had to sleep on our sofa because we didn't have money for a hotel room. You know, we live in a world now where a 32-year-old artist demands a room at the Four Seasons for a week, right? And that will be my last old man cranky statement tonight. But I had to get it in. And it's a true story. Richard Serra on our sofa. Can you imagine, Pat? Do you remember that? I do. You do? I know you do. So I'm very grateful to Fort Worth because they let me build the sculpture that I wanted to build in Berkeley but never got to build. When we think of contemporary art, it's reflexive to think of youth. But youth is not a guarantee of innovation by any means. In fact, age could be thought of as the backbone of the avant-garde, because people who have experience in their life know when they're doing something innovative. Younger artists are not quite clear about it yet. When I was in Berkeley, I was told of this old guy, 59. I thought, wow, ancient. Guy was 59, and he was in the Mission District of San Francisco, and I should go look at his work. So they gave me his address. I went to this house. This is the house of Jess. I walked up those steps. I knocked on the door. You see the curtains on the right side of the stairwell? They parted slightly. Then they closed. Then nobody answered the door. I rang again. Then they didn't part. I went back home. The friend who told me about Jess, I said, what is this about? I saw this guy. He was like peeking out the window. And he said, I forgot to tell you. He's a little bit of a recluse. And, you know, what we should probably do is call him and tell him you're coming at a specific time, which is what we did. And I went. And I sat down and listened to his story, and it changed my life. I mean, I never looked at art the same after this. I can't tell you how, but this guy was born Burgess Franklin Collins in Long Beach, California in 1923. He received a master's degree in chemical engineering from Caltech in Pasadena and then was drafted into the Army. And because of his education, he was immediately assigned to the famous Manhattan Project to make plutonium for the atom bomb. True story. After the war, he went to work for General Electric in Hanford, Washington. It was called the Hanford Project to develop nuclear energy for as a consumer product. In 1949, he had a dream. He calls it a dream. That the world would be annihilated by nuclear energy in 1975. And he decided that with the time, and he believed it, it was an intense dream. He decided with the time, and he had this job in Hanford, he was making good money, he became a Sunday painter. He was making paintings of flowers and things like that. Loved it, really enjoyed making his flower art. After the dream, he decided, I have to become an artist. I can't go on like this. So he quit his job with General Electric. He drove south to San Francisco, and with his GI Bill, applied to the University Art Museum, the University of California, Berkeley's art department. They looked at his resume, his education, and they said, we won't let you into the art department until you undergo psychological testing. That's got to be a first, really. The art department wants you to take a psychological test to get in? Seriously. And he was pissed, and so there was another school across the bay called the San Francisco Art Institute. He went over there. It was a private school. They let him in right away. And lo and behold, one of the famous teachers that was there was Clifford Still. Mark Rothko had been there. Ed Reinhardt had been there. He lucked into it, in a way. And he started learning how to make art. And he started by making these very thick, you know, Clifford Still's paintings are very thick and sort of conjoined. And very thick paintings from images he found in old Scientific American magazines of scientific experiments. This is our painting. Jess was obsessed with nuclear energy and the sun because he saw the sun as the most powerful nuclear explosion, a continuous nuclear explosion. Our painting is called Montana Xibalba, which is about how the Aztecs developed their concept of the universe, which was that it was developed by a ball game. And the soccer players kicked the balls around, and that's how the universe was developed. They're basically giant soccer balls floating around the universe. And Jess was a famous collagist. He made these extremely intricate collages from steel engravings and other magazines he'd found and used bookstores. Hundreds of pieces of little fragments, and he had an X-Acto knife that had a pivot on it so he could get really perfect cuts. And he saw collage as a kind of molecular structure, all these molecules coming together in fragments of pieces of paper. This is Jess's studio office on the third floor of the house. I was going to New York a lot in the 1970s and 1980s. And it was an exciting place to be. Soho was transforming from light industry into artist lofts. And the streets were very gritty, but with a lot of artist presence. And you would see the walls of buildings would be covered with cheap Xerox posters. One day you would go down a street and the entire street would be covered with posters for the Ramones. Then the next day you'd go down the street and it would be for a performance of Laurie Anderson. And, you know, they were all just stapled. Just really, you were paid like $4 an hour to go around. And so the streets of New York were like a giant collage. And this artist named Jenny Holzer decided she could participate in that collage with some of her posters that were made of what she called truisms. And the truisms were not necessarily true, but not necessarily false. They were not necessarily male. They were not necessarily female. It took me a while to engage Jenny because I thought for the longest time that she was a radical feminist. And I didn't know how to talk about feminism at that time. If a woman asked me what I thought about feminism, I said, good idea. You know, that's as far as I could get. But I followed Jenny's work for a long time, and the truisms really started to get me thinking about how she was participating in the art world, not as a female, but not as a male, but sort of a voice of authority. And both Susan Rothenberg and Jenny Holzer really taught me as a young curator that the field was getting leveled, that Susan was as good a painter as any male artist I knew. And Jenny, when you see Jenny's truisms on a jumbotron in Times Square, that's as big as Richard Serra. That's powerful stuff. In 1980, I moved to the Ringling Museum of Art in Sarasota, Florida. Short little chapter in my life. It was a museum built by the wealthy John Ringling, the circus impresario. When I left Berkeley to go to the Ringling, Jim Elliott told Alana Heiss of PS1 that I had run away to join the circus. And he was kind of right. Sarasota was a weird place. It was full of old retirees, bartenders, waitresses, and the dentists and internal surgeons who kept the older people alive. And I was brought down there to start their new contemporary program. And yet there weren't that many contemporary artists in the town. But there was one. There was one. And his name was John Chamberlain. And because of our isolation, we became very, very close. And I would see John. I would go to John's studio every 2 weeks. He lived about 8 blocks from where Pat and I lived. And He had a huge warehouse on a street called 10 Coconut Avenue. I mean, you gotta love that. And John is famous for making sculpture out of crushed car parts. And his studio at 10 Coconut looked like this. An amazing place. And he had this huge, it was like 50-foot long metal crusher that he could put a hood in and just crank it down, torque this thing into some shape, pull it out, set it down, take another piece, and then he would fit them together. And I asked him, over many, many beers and joints and everything else, we would talk, and always say, how did you get to the cars? How did the cars become your thing? And he said, well, the story I tell everybody is that I was at Larry Rivers' house in the Hamptons at a party, and I was leaving, and there was an old fender on the side of the road. I ran over it, got out to look at it. It was twisted in a way that I thought was really neat. And I took it back to my studio, and I started putting these things together. But then as we got drunker, he said, but really, the real story is about compression. It's about, sculpture's all about compression. It's about how your nervous system reacts with another material, compressing it. And John was a big, tough guy. He's an ex-Navy man, tattoos all over, hard drinking. You know, I mean, this is a guy that you go out at night, you've got to be prepared to handle the evening. And so we're talking, and John says, so the real story is that I was a hairdresser. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, when I got out of the Navy on the GI Bill, I went to beautician school. And I learned to cut hair, and I learned to do makeup. And he said, the process of using scissors, of cutting scissors through hair, made me think about compression, made me think about sculpture. And eventually I went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago to become a sculptor. This is a photograph of John Chamberlain with Diana Ross in the Supremes. And Diana Ross's mother in the lower right-hand corner, who John, he did her hair. So whenever I think, I mean, art is, the great thing about art is it's just, there's always a new turn, you know? So whenever I look at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth, John Chamberlain sculpture, I see a hairdo. I mean, it's, I don't know, you know, I see this thing being formed like, you know. This is interesting. So I'm in Sarasota, Florida, and I get a call from a guy named David Ryan at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. And he said, I'd like you to come and interview for a curatorial job I have. And I said, okay, I'll come down. This is a sheet from Susan Colgrove's calendar. Susan Colgrove was David Ryan's executive assistant. When I eventually came to Fort Worth, she became my assistant. But let's backtrack, shall we? So this is her calendar. She gave this to me a few years ago. Michael Opping arrives and leaves Delta Flight 125, 10:45 a.m. I came, I met with David Ryan. We talked about the job, we went to lunch, and I got on a Delta flight and flew back to Florida. We hit it off really well. I knew, you know, I was pretty certain I got the job. You know, everything was good. I waited a week, didn't hear anything. Waited 2 weeks, nothing. So basically, I thought, wow, this is really bullshit. What happened was, that I later found out, was that a week after I interviewed with David Ryan, he was fired. And someone was involved in that firing, and I'm not even going to go there. But So I never heard from them. I thought, man, this Fort Worth thing is really getting on my nerves. So fortunately, I was lucky enough to land the job of chief curator at the Albright Knox Art Gallery in Buffalo, New York. This is arguably one of the finest small museums in the world, in the area of modern art. We're talking about Paul Gauguin's Spirit of the Dead Watching from 1892, one of his greatest Tahitian paintings. We're talking about Paul Cézanne's Morning in Provence, 1902, the beginning of abstraction. We're talking about Pablo Picasso's Cubist Nude from 1908. Talking about Vasily Kandinsky's composition number 7 from 1913, arguably one of the first abstract paintings ever made. I mean, these paintings are embedded in my mind. It was an incredible education. Franz Klein's New York, New York, 1955. Willem de Kooning's Gotham News, 1955. Clifford Still's Untitled, 1957. And, of course, Jackson Pollock's famous Convergence. It's a 16-foot-long Pollock drip painting. On the right is a photograph of the director of the Albright Knox, Douglas Schultz, Seymour H. Knox, who purchased this Pollock painting for the museum, and me, in a pair of large glasses. Seymour Knox was a patrician man. I mean, you know, from California, I had always heard the term WASP. And he was a classic WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant from old money, a great guy who was very, very edgy, who bought many of the paintings I just showed you and gave them directly to the museum. His father was a co-founder of Woolworth's department stores. He was a co-founder of Marine Midland Bank and of Time Magazine. And he was buying this radical stuff, sending it to the museum. And local artists in Buffalo were picketing the museum because they thought it was crap. They thought, this is ridiculous. The museum has gone to hell in a handbag. And Mr. Knox always supported his curators. And remember, I came to this sort of old school museum from L.A., Berkeley, beach town of Sarasota, Florida, to Buffalo. I didn't have a sports coat. I mean, I was wearing jeans and khakis and things like that. And I remember Mr. Knox, the sweetest thing he ever said. He said, "Michael, you give us good advice. Would you permit me to give you some? A blue blazer." He said, "Get two of them. Weddings, funerals, business meetings. They're perfect for everything. I wore them at Yale. I wear them now. Get a blue blazer." It was at the Albright Knox that I first met Agnes Martin, who is an unbelievable woman. I mean, I don't know how to describe her. We were doing an exhibition at the Albright Knox on a woman named Mabel Dodge, who was a famous Buffalo socialite who had moved to the Taos area and started an art colony. And the legacy of Mabel Dodge would sort of end with Agnes Martin and Susan Rothenberg, if you will. Visiting Agnes Martin's studio was very close to a spiritual experience. It was a very small, room-like space with a little niche, with enough room for one painting only. She wanted only one painting to fit in there because she said, "When I'm working on a painting, it's that painting. There's nothing else. I don't want room in my mind or in my studio for anything else." This is a photograph of me and Agnes at an opening in Santa Fe of a show I did that she was a part of. I'm pretty sure we called each other that evening to coordinate our colors, to make sure that everything was copacetic. And, you know, Agnes was always a zen slap, you know. If you said something to her nice, she'd kind of slap you back. And I remember saying to her once, "You know, Agnes, I really appreciate our friendship. And she shot back at me and she said, I don't have any friends, and you're one of them. So it just goes to show the dreams do come true. So when I was at the Albright Knox, I was invited. There were like about 30 curators around the United States that were invited to submit proposals for the American Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. And I submitted a proposal, and I said I would like to do a big show of Jenny Holzer in the American Pavilion. And this is a perfect truism for that, that it was a very, very intense time. The Venice Biennale was held every 2 years. It was then, and maybe still is, considered the premier event for contemporary art internationally. And this one was particularly significant because, first of all, Jenny would, if they chose it, and they did choose it, Jenny was the first woman to ever represent the United States in the American Pavilion. It was also one of the most ambitious exhibitions ever proposed for the American Pavilion. And it was the most expensive exhibition by far ever put together at the American Pavilion. It cost almost $1 million, which in 1990 dollars was a lot of money. But we infiltrated the city with Jenny Holzer. You know, when you arrived at the airport in Venice, there were truisms on the LED signs. When you took the Vaporetto down the canals, there were truisms in the Vaporettos. When you walked along the canal, there were truisms on T-shirts being sold. When you went into the American Pavilion, you found Jenny's truisms and a variety of other texts carved into Italian stone, the kind of stone that's used in Venice. And then there were two rooms that were filled with LED signs. And these were very hot rooms indeed. We called them the microwave rooms. And the marble was polished to a high sheen so that when the truisms were falling down the wall, they were doubled on the floor. Not unlike sometimes you see the holes are here on the water. I remember at the opening speaking with Yoko Ono, and she came and we were talking about feminism. Again, it was a big deal that this was the first woman, and here's a guy who doesn't even know how to talk about feminism who is the curator of the show. And and we were talking about it. I'll never forget. She was so nice. And Yoko, what did she say? I wrote it down. I said, you know, I don't really, I feel uncomfortable talking about feminism. I just think this is good art. And she said, you know, feminism is not about talking. It's about doing. You're doing it. Leave it at that. Let it go. So you may recognize this building. So I'm at the heart of my career, right? At the peak of my career, I should say. Not at the heart of it. At the peak of my career. And I get a call from the Fort Worth Art Museum. And I thought, my God, no. Not this again. No. Not this again. This is a curse, you know. And a woman named Marla Price calls and asks if I would like to interview to be the chief curator of the museum. I thought, haven't I done this? And I didn't tell her about the David Ryan experience or the Sid Bass experience. I just said, no, I don't want to interview. And we hung up. She called me about I said, I don't want to go to Fort Worth. I don't want to come to Fort Worth to interview. And she called me about a week later and she said, look, you don't have to come to Fort Worth. How about if I come to you in Buffalo? And I thought, okay, that would work. In February. And she came in February. I'm sure she had to throw those shoes away, everything. She came. We hit it off really well, had a couple of glasses of wine, and she started to talk me into this idea that if you come here, you know, this is a very serious board, and I think they will, you know, you come, you do serious, ambitious exhibitions, we'll build a new building. I said, well, okay, and I did. I did, and I'm glad I did. And so we had to start doing some serious, ambitious exhibitions right away. And the first thing that I did was invite my old friends down to take over the museum. What did we say in Texas? Dance with the ones who brung you? Well, Richard Serra, Saul LeWitt, and Jonathan Borofsky. I brought them down to do a show called Wall Drawings. And they came and they covered the walls of the old museum with big monumental drawings. It was a fantastic show. My only regret is I can't imagine how that show would look in the new building. It would be astounding. But things happen when they happen. And prior to my coming to the museum, the previous director before Marla, E.A. Carmian, had decided that the museum should focus on American art. And I really was of the opinion that in the latter half of the 70s and throughout the 80s, all of the action was in Europe. It was not in America. And what we needed to do was go to Europe and start looking. And we did, and we ended up buying this Georg Baselitz painting. This was one of Baselitz's early upside-down paintings. He literally paints the paintings upside down, meaning he doesn't paint it right side up and then flip it. So he does that to throw himself out of trying to make something look exactly like what he's painting. And that was an incredible experience to engage. Marla and I talked about, let's just look at the big three. And in my opinion, the big three were Georg Baselitz, Gerhard Richter, and Anselm Kiefer. There were other great German artists, but mostly the Germans were the ones that were really creating energy in the international art world. This is Baselitz's studio in Dernenberg, Germany. It's a castle / convent that he turned into a studio with amazing painting and printmaking studios. And one of my fondest memories, this is Georg Baselitz on the right. One of my fondest memories was bringing Georg Baselitz to Fort Worth, Texas. And we went to a barbecue, hayride, ranch festival at the Murren Ranch. And he was speechless. He was singing cowboy songs and drinking whiskey. Now, Anselm Kiefer was not so much fun. But Kiefer was one of the most controversial and important artists in the 1980s in Europe and certainly in Germany. And he's famous, of course, for photographing himself in a Nazi uniform, giving the Nazi salute in various parts of Europe. He was born in 1945 at the end of World War II, so he was a generation that was taught not to remember. And his whole body of work is about making sure that Germans remember. So he would do paintings that resembled ovens or tombs. And I remember visiting his studio in outside of Frankfurt. It was the old, I think it was Frankfurt, or Stuttgart. Where?
Hanschweig.
Okay. And it was an old brick factory. And it was where they literally made bricks. And those doors at the very back are ovens. You know, ovens mean something to Germans who went through World War II. And in this these basement storage facilities. He had everything from lead to human hair and human teeth. And in his studio in Barjac, he built a series of tunnels that led to small rooms that you would walk into. And in one of these rooms, I remember seeing a pair of lead wings hanging from the ceiling. And a very similar pair of those wings ended up in a concrete room here in the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. So apparently the exhibitions were ambitious enough, the board was happy enough, and off we went. Off we went. I mean, I have to say that, and my colleagues know this, I don't like to bring it up a lot, just enough to rub it in. No curator has had it as good as I have had it. To be able to do the exhibitions I want to do, work on a building with Tadao Ando, help design the galleries of the building, and buy the art for those galleries. Doesn't happen. Take my word for it. Just doesn't happen. And this is really where the fun began, after the new building. So the first show in the new building, as you all will remember, was of the permanent collection. And what we did was we showed the permanent collection, which had a core group of really good works, but also this amazing patron, Ann Marion, who had raised a lot of money to build this building, and we refer to her as the mother of the modern. She gave us $10 million to buy art for the opening of the new building. And so we bought Martin Puryear's Ladder with Booker T. Washington. We bought Francis Bacon's first self-portrait, 1955. We bought Gerhard Richter's Seascape, 1966, 67. And we bought Andy Warhol's Frightwig painting. Now, this could not be done today. Not even close. I paid $425,000 for that painting. And I'm almost embarrassed to say that when I was talking to the guy at the Warhol Foundation and he wanted $500,000, I said, no, I'll give you $425,000. And I said, and I have a board that's very wealthy and we'll get you a check right away. So if you don't say yes, you're walking away from $425,000. So we got it for $425,000. One of these, not as good, sold for $32 million not too long ago. So, and you can, the Francis Bacon is arguably worth $60, $65 million. $10 million won't buy you the work, of, in some cases, of a 35-year-old artist in this art market. Timing, just timing. The first show we did that was not permanent collection was of Philip Guston, an artist who broke all boundaries, who is one of the great artists. And it was important for me to do Philip Guston because Guston is an artist that artists appreciate, that artists know is good. It wasn't about pleasing the public. It was about pleasing artists. And then we did a show called Declaring Space. And in many ways, this was an homage to the space in Ondo's building, to allow the space of Ondo's walls and doorways to open up to these great paintings by Barnett Newman and Lucio Fontana, Yves Klein, Mark Rothko. And then Frank Stella, what I call the winter of Frank Stella. A great artist who was represented in a number of Fort Worth collections and in our museum, who hadn't had a retrospective in four decades. An artist who took abstract painting off the wall and advanced it into the space of the room. He made painting materialistic. And he looked good in Fort Worth. And I'll end with Lucian Freud, which was a remarkable show that I was very privileged to work on with the National Portrait Gallery in London. And I was very nervous. I had always wanted to meet Lucian Freud, but I was very, very nervous about meeting him for the first time. And when I did, I arrived at his studio an hour early. I was so nervous that I'd be late. And of course, you don't just knock on the door an hour early. So I walked around his Kensington neighborhood for 55 minutes. My feet were killing me. And finally, at like 4 minutes to the hour that I was supposed to be there, I walked up and I rang the doorbell. And the door opened immediately. And this guy was staring at me. And he said, "You're 4 minutes early." Me, German. And I said, "Well, fortunately, I'm always early. My wife tells me I'm always early, so I always have an answer." It's that I was a premature baby. And I told Lucian, "You know, I could have been here 3 weeks ago. You're lucky. I'm only 4 minutes early." And he said, "Fair enough. Come on in." And why was I so nervous to meet this, like, 5'5" guy who is, you know, sort of almost frail? Well, first of all, he's the grandson of Sigmund Freud, the inventor of psychoanalysis. That's number one. Number two, he's a painter of nudes, mostly female nudes. He's a raconteur. He was a gambler. He was a late part of the late night London scene. He was legendary. And so that's why I was nervous. But going into his studio was one of the most fascinating experiences. It's a small room with a bed where many of his models laid. Lucian was married twice, had two children by his first wife. When he died, he had 15 children, all to his mistresses and his models. And if you look at the wall on the right, that's paint. Lucian didn't like using a palette, so he would mix his colors on the wall of the studio. And at a certain point, they just became like an encrusted grotto. And he got these linens from local restaurants that he used to wipe his paintbrushes. Lucian, his grandfather was very much about the mind, Sigmund Freud, but Lucian was all about the body, and he was fascinated with flesh. And his position was, "You know, Michael, if you like flesh and you want to paint flesh, get someone who has a lot of it." And he did. These are amazing pictures. This is Lucian's last self-portrait, and I love it because it shows him and his face blending back into the paint of his studio. He died right before our show opened, but he faded out, and it was, well, if you saw it, it was an amazing show. So I'll fade out now. And thank you for everything. Thank you, Fort Worth, for all you've done for our family. And it's been great to be here.
So I think if you have questions for Michael, you can catch him with a drink in his hand in the lobby. We have a reception as a way to say goodbye. We love you.